I was very proud of my dad and my proximity to him. I was a pastor's kid, right? And I kind of thought of that as a job, as a role. It was my job to connect with the visitors' kids and to build relationships and whatnot. They never like set it down and said, you have a responsibility to do this. I just liked it. I liked my role.
My name is Tim Anderson. Welcome to Father and Friend, where men learn to live for the good of their families.
What does it mean to be a father to you?
What does it mean to be a father? Well, I guess you could define that, you know, biologically, like having progeny, having offspring, having a child. But that's not really the first thing that springs to mind for me. What springs to mind for me is a relationship. And I'm blessed, we'll get to this with the other questions, but I'm blessed to have had a largely fantastic relationship with my own dad. And grandparents and other father figures growing up to fathers of friends and whatnot. A lot of different examples of what a father might look like, but largely positive. So when I hear the question, what is a father? There's a picture that springs to mind, and it's a relational one. The father figure is what is in my head, and I can't think of a succinct way to describe that, except to say that it's a whole person. Like it's a whole person in a relationship with you. That's a father, and of course that connects to my background as a Christian as well, and how the Bible talks about God the Father. So it'd be really hard for me to unwind all of that. It's all so wrapped together.
Yeah, very good. Tell me about your father then. You said there's a picture in your head of what that looks like. What is that picture that you have based on your own upbringing?
Well, it's probably, I don't know, 60, 70, 75% based on my relationship with my own dad. And then the rest, all those other kind of relationships that I mentioned with men or just with the Lord. So my relationship with my dad was a strong relationship. It was a positive relationship. He was very present in the home. For a large portion of my childhood, he was a pastor. He worked in the ministry, and a lot of days were partially or totally working from home. It was a small church, so the church had an office, but there was no reason to be there all day, every day. And there wasn't like a big staff to go participate in. So he was in the house. Lots of my memories of him working, for example, when I was a kid, are of him in the family playroom, essentially, because there wasn't a room for an office. So oftentimes the same room we were doing school in, he was at his desk with his computer doing sermon prep and research. So like that's how I think of work, my dad working. So that meant he was present for most, if not all, meals. And we did have a dining room table and we did sit at it. And I know that that's kind of a rarefied thing nowadays. So my relationship with him was very much one of presence. Like he was present. He was present all the time.
When you were a kid, did you think about your schoolwork as work? Because you're sitting next to dad, he's doing work.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And of course, school didn't take as long. Like, dad worked longer than we did. We could finish our school faster and get to playtime and whatnot. But there was definitely the idea that I had a responsibility to take care of school, whether or not I enjoyed it every day. And dad had his responsibilities too, to work. Of course, being a pastor, I was aware that not all of his work was sitting at the computer, sermon prepping. The other side of being a pastor is highly relational. So meeting with people, going to events, being present in the community, and starting at a pretty young age, probably seven or eight, Dad would bring us with him as often as he could. And I was the oldest and I was the only boy, so I was most often the one brought with him. You know, there were all kinds of meetings he would go to, or just settings that were not appropriate for babies or toddlers or whatnot. So they'd stay home with mom. But me, and then later some of my other siblings, he would just bring along. So I remember going to conferences with him. I remember he'd have a speaking engagement and he'd bring me along and I'd just be in the audience. So not only was work, not only was work, my schoolwork and him doing his sermon prep on his computer, but then there was this aspect of work that I got to be present for, if not directly involved with. And so I was very proud of my dad and my proximity to him. Like, I was a pastor's kid, right? And I kind of thought of that as a job, as a role. You know, my role was to be the pastor's kid. So if it was mom and dad's job to connect with visitors to the church, then it was my job to connect with the visitors' kids and to build relationships and whatnot. I don't think I thought like a lot of kids think, but that is how my mind worked.
Yeah, did your parents prep you for that, or is that something that you just adopted?
Probably subtly. Probably, hey, they're new here, you know, go talk to them. But they never like set it down and said, you have a responsibility to do this. I just liked it. I liked my role. I liked being, I'm social, definitely what you would consider to be an extrovert. And so, yeah, mom and dad definitely succeeded in giving a very safe, environment, both at home and at church and everywhere we were, for us to be relational with people and to be on the same side and like have the same goals as my parents. There was a lot of unity there. And I'm painting a very rosy picture here, right? It wasn't all perfect. We weren't always happy. We weren't always nice to each other. But how I think back to this time in my life is how I'm describing it.
It's a positive memory overall.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
That's neat.
And I'm sure that my parents were really, I'm sure that my mom and dad both had to be really intentional with creating that environment for us and including us to the extent that they did, including me to the extent that they did.
Do you feel like you've recognized that as you then have your own children? The challenge?
Yeah, so I've only been a dad for 4 years. I have a 4-year-old and a 9-month-old now. So I definitely have a desire to include my 4-year-old in things, but a lot of the ideas in my head are kind of a not yet. They're like, oh, once it gets a little bit older, a little bit bigger, do this and that. At the same time, though, there are a couple things that I've been able to include him in. Not really my work per se, because I did not have the benefit of working from home for most of the last 4 years. I was gone, not present. But being at home, taking care of chores, going on errands, I actually have already noticed that I really enjoy it when I can bring my son along with me. For example, last summer, I bought this device that allowed me to carry him like a piggyback. It put it like a bar back here for him to stand on and have handles for him to grab. And he liked that. He never liked the carriers that like feel really restrictive. Since he was a baby, he didn't like that. But he felt like he was just taking a ride. And so I'd put that on and we'd go to the grocery store and we'd go shopping. And I took him one time to go get the tires changed on the car, which he thought was the coolest thing ever. And they had one of those windows to watch while the tires were changed. And he'll still talk about, if we drive by the tire store, he'll say, Dad, that's where we got the tires. I'm like, yep, that's it. And he's 4, you know? But it made an impact on him and gave me so much joy to include him in. Even though it's hard, even though it's really hard sometimes to have a 2 or a 3 or a 4-year-old in the middle of a chore.
Yeah. You may have mentioned this already, but what's one or two things that your dad did that you would continue to do? And it sounds like one of those would be include your children in what you're doing.
Yes, definitely. Carrying them along as much as possible was something that my dad did. And I think as an adult looking back, I think that contributed greatly to my worldview, how I see the world, how I see life, how I see parenthood. Is very largely shaped by all of those come along moments, mm-hmm. including ones that happened with like my grandfather. Like he was retired most of the time that I was a child. So he would take me on like fishing trips and camping trips, and we would always call them adventures. Mm-hmm. But the come along kind of relationship, come along with me, I'm going to go do this thing. That's something that I'm fully committed to applying as a dad. What's something else? I know something else my dad did was we used dinner time at the table for a couple of different things over the course of my childhood. When I was really young, I remember that became memorized Bible verse time. And there was a little box of index cards with Bible verses on it, and he would take one out, and we would spend a week or a couple weeks memorizing it, and then he'd pull out the next one, and we would spend a week or a couple weeks memorizing it.
Was that fun for you guys?
Yes, it was absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we complained. Mm-hmm. I guarantee we complained, but like I have a memory, I couldn't have been older than four or five. I could not have been older than four or five of us memorizing this verse. And it was later stages, so Dad was trying to get us to remember it and not tell us what it was. And we remembered the beginning, remembered for all have sinned. And then we couldn't remember the rest. And Dad was over there like, he was trying to show fall short. Of all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And I remember, like, I couldn't have been older than four or five. And then later, when we grew up a little bit and we got towards, I know this now, but like as a kid, I didn't know they were doing this. But as we got older to the point where we could consider the gospel and we could consider actual things pertaining to salvation, then they started using the dinner time to go through Bible stories. They'd get a children's Bible. At first, it wasn't even a children's Bible. At first, it was just a Bible, and they would read stories, and then we would discuss them while we ate. So we'd sit down, pray. He would let us start eating, and then Dad would read the story before he started eating, and then we would talk about it for the rest of the meal. And I went through some stories, scoping the whole Bible, and we did it again for each of my siblings. I had three younger siblings. Mm-hmm. So each time, as when my younger siblings were doing it, I noticed that it was happening. Get to like 4, 5, 6 years old, and Mom and Dad would start going through the whole Bible mm-hmm. with the whole family, but for that child. Mm-hmm. Eventually, we all got baptized towards the end of those processes. I think I got baptized when I was 8 years old. And there's debates about when you should do that kind of thing with your kids. But because of how my parents did it, I think we were as knowledgeable as we possibly could have been about what we were doing, what the Bible actually says about Jesus and what he did for us. Mm-hmm. So redeeming that family time and making it the family time around the table, making it useful for memorizing scripture, learning the Bible, discussing the Bible. That's something that they did that I definitely want to do. I want to carry that forward.
That's great. That's exciting. What's one thing that your dad did that you have chosen not to continue? You don't have to throw your dad under the bus Well, maybe let me put it this way. What's one thing that you will not repeat
So dad had a different taste of music to me, I'd say. So we'd get in the car and he liked, like, he was a pastor, right? So in my mind, even in my child brain, I thought there was some incongruity here. He just liked popular music, pop music, sometimes rap music. There was nothing, I don't think, any that was super inappropriate, but it was just kind of weird in tone, given that we were, you know, this conservative Christian family, pastors' kids. But yeah, no, he would turn on music that had a lot of bass and crank it up as we were in the car. And I never learned to like it. So that's definitely not something that I do.
did you find yourself kind of embarrassed by that?
Maybe a little. Definitely confused and maybe occasionally embarrassed. I'm like, isn't this not the kind of, are we supposed to like,
did it feel a little bit like Christian the Office music? Space, you know, that Office Space scene where the guy's driving down the highway and he cranks up this music?
Yes, I do know the scene you're talking about. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Something, yeah. Some of my younger siblings liked the music eventually, and so that was better, but I was always just like a little uncomfortable. I've been weird like that my whole life, obviously. I'm not going to play pop music in the car. It's just not what I want.
That was an easy one. That's an easy one not to do. There's probably other things, but...
Yeah, no, there's, I mean, it's not perfect.
It's easier for me because my dad's dead. So, like, I can say something.
You say anything.
Dad. Yeah. And it's like, there's not going to be any repercussions for me.
Well, to be fair, I don't think my dad would be mad at me for just about anything. He's very open and forgiving.
Is there anything of... consequence that you would not continue?
Yeah, let me think on that a second.
Or anything that you learned from your dad that you would love to do better? And I say that in the context of, I hope that my children want to be better parents than me. And you know what I'm saying? In that sense.
Yeah, because otherwise they're just like, I'm going to be just like my dad.
Yeah.
Which is not...
No, that's not great.
That's not
No. I mean, I hope I have some good attributes they would like to continue.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's plenty of things.
Hopefully they have discernment, right?
Yeah, that's right. To go, yeah, you know what? Dad wasn't the best at that. And that's okay. I can accept that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think my dad was super great at conflict or taking criticism. Which is not something I recognized when I was a kid, but I think that when he was criticized or when he thought he was being criticized, that he reacted very defensively. And my dad was good with words, so he could usually like talk his way to some sort of justification or the end of the conversation without really having to face the criticism. And I've definitely seen him do that, to rationalize and justify instead of trying to handle the conflict or the piece of feedback or criticism that he could have taken.
Like taking responsibility for at least his portion of it, even if it was a small portion.
And that feeds into like his relationship with my mom. They're both like type A personalities, so conflict was a norm. And I don't even think that was a bad thing, but it was rare that my mom and dad could move past their two separate positions and find common ground. They were better at voicing their two separate opinions, sometimes loudly. Like, they would definitely shout or raise their voice. Now, they weren't like, they didn't curse, they didn't threaten each other. It was more just like heated argument about the thing. It could be dishes, you know, and they could raise their voice about it and have two very different opinions. They were good at, after raising their voice and having an argument, moving on. But I don't think that it was usually because they had come to common ground. I think it was more of a, well, we're just not going to deal with this anymore. And that's an example of like where dad could have taken ownership, taking responsibility for as much as possible in those arguments. I feel like it was more justify, rationalize until the conversation's done. And that's not who I want to be generally or with my spouse.
Do you feel like that's something that you've seen in yourself as you're married, have children? Do you see that something similar there?
Absolutely. Yes. No, it takes active consideration and effort on my part to not do that.
So what is your steps to not do that?
Well, when I'm successful, it's usually to be quiet. Instead of offering the ready explanation, which is in my head and on the tip of my tongue and ready to go, success in this would be closing my mouth, or even better, asking an open-ended question instead. And it's like, well, tell me more about that, or tell me why you think that, or and just listening more. Something I've definitely failed at a lot, but in the moments when I've succeeded at that, if I listen long enough, I realize I don't need to say anything I was about to say. It's usually never helpful or even what the conversation is really about in a deeper sense. It's just my first gut response to rationalize and explain how right I am, you know? I'll show you all 15 ways that I'm right. But what I should really do is listen to what you have to say, even if it's just one way that I'm wrong. I have my 15 right, but if there's just one way that I'm wrong, then I could and should learn from that.
Yeah, that's good. What are some ways that you prioritize your family?
Yeah, so prioritizing family is hard. Prioritizing anything is hard in a conscious way, because it seems to me that it's really easy to live on some form of autopilot where I do what I want to do when I want to do it. And taking control of that, being the pilot instead of having autopilot do it for me, and deciding where my priorities lie and aligning my schedule or my money, my resources with my priorities, that's hard. There's all kinds of little tools that I've heard. Like, for example, we have time, talent, and treasure. That's what the Lord has given us. And we could use it accidentally or incidentally as we just wander through life, which would probably end up meaning a lot of video games for me, a lot of TV time, a lot of reading books that I enjoy, or align my time, talent, and treasure with my priorities. So having conversations with my wife and eventually with my kids. I don't think they're quite old enough to have that yet, but where we talk about what we believe are our highest priorities in life is the number one my relationship with the Lord. I've stated I believe it should be. Having an open conversation about whether or not that's true. Second priority being relationship with my wife. Third with my kids. Fourth with my community. Fifth with my work. That's how, for many years now, that's how my priority list has landed when I think about it. But every time I bring it up and I think about it, I find inconsistencies with how I'm living compared to what my stated priorities are. And there's this quote that I thought was really impactful. People say what they think, but do what they believe. And so when there's a difference between what you're thinking and what you're doing, then you have an incongruity between what you're thinking and what you believe. So if I can say, these are my five priorities and this is the rank order.
That's a good quote.
That's what I think. Say what
they
think
and do what they believe.
Yeah. That's what I think. That's good. I don't know who said it originally.
It's clever, though.
It just stuck in my brain. When I say, these are my five priorities and this is the rank order, that's what I think. And then I look at my life to see where my time, talent, and treasure are going on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. If it doesn't line up with that, then I'm living out beliefs that are different, and there's something wrong there.
No, that's good. That's good. So you prioritize your family by...
Oh yeah, the original question. I thought I avoided that expertly.
You gave a good essay on what it could look like and the structures by which you could prioritize it.
Yeah. Well, I brought it up, and that heuristic of time, talent, and treasure, because that's one way to check in, see like it is any portion or what portion of my time is going to my family, what portion of my treasure, which is money, resources, and what portion of my talent. The talent one is interesting, that I think a lot of people don't recognize, is that you have skills and you probably are using them in other areas of your life. Like you use whatever skills you have in your work, where you build skills at work that you use. And it's one of the things that you have that offers value to your employer and, you know, increases your economic utility and all of this. You have skills, you have talent, but it's the one I forget about most applying at home. Mm. Like if you have skills, do you apply them in your life with your family? Mm. For example, I got told at work many years ago that I had a strength in emotional intelligence and listening to people and making them feel heard. I was told that at work. At that exact time and season, my wife was not feeling that. Mm-hmm. She would not have agreed mm-hmm. that I had strong emotional intelligence and I was good at listening and making people feel heard. Mm-hmm. So a total mismatch. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't applying my talent, which I obviously had this talent, to my family. Mm-hmm. And I think and hope that I'm better at that today than I was then. But yeah, so taking inventory of where your time's going, where your money's going, and where your talent and your skills are going, and just seeing, is any of it going to your family, first of all? And then, like, what proportion of it? And are you satisfied with the proportion that you find? You know, if I spend an hour a day with my kids because I wake up early and go to the gym, and then I go straight to work, and then I get home from work, and there's an hour left before their bedtime. If that's how my day looks, am I content with that? Mm. Can I, like, prayerfully approach that subject with the Lord without feeling conviction mm-hmm. or shame, even, that, like, hey, what you're doing? And maybe there's seasons in life where that kind of a thing is required, or maybe you have a job where that kind of a thing is mandated. You know, if you're in the army serving our country, then you might be gone for months at a time. And I don't necessarily think that means you're doing something wrong or sinful, right? But being cognizant of where your time, talent, and treasure are going, and whether or not that's appropriate to where you are in life, to where your kids are. I assume an hour a day with a 25-year-old child would be amazing and maybe even excessive, but an hour a day with my 3-year-old seems lacking. That doesn't seem like enough to me, and that's subjective, I know. But you can approach that with prayer, and you can approach that with trying to get counsel from godly people, from other fathers you respect, and say, like, is this... like, am I present to the extent that I should be in my life right now? Mm. My family's life? Wife of my wife? Wife of my kids? Mm.
I love that idea of taking the skills you have at work and applying them to your house, or just taking your skills in general and applying them. I remember having a conversation with someone at one point that was similar, and it was things like, when you're at work and you need help, you get training. Mm-hmm. You find a mentor. You schedule meetings.
Yep.
You make agendas for those meetings. Mm-hmm. You don't show up without being prepared.
Exactly.
And so oftentimes we show up to our families without being prepared.
With none of that.
Yeah, we just show up and expect something to happen.
Yeah. And get mad at other people when
when
it
they show up,
go right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And so there's something very true about, for some reason, I don't know if it's American culture, I don't know, or if it's just sinfulness or just humans, but the compartmentalization of family versus work, and family becoming kind of a hobby or a side project.
Yeah.
And work is really my main thing. And we often neglect this piece, but as you mentioned, there's not every skill translates very well, but many skills do translate really mm-hmm. well. And you mentioned a really good one, which is the, if you're a manager anywhere, you've probably had to listen to someone who you might not be super happy with.
Oh yeah.
And so you've at least practiced a skill that could be useful in a loving environment. And obviously there's a different approach. You can't take that and use that skill for your own self-interest at home. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just self-centeredness.
Yeah.
It's not love then. It's just manipulation.
Manipulation, yeah. Exactly. And I've seen that kind of thing happen too.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend at one time who got his psychology degree, and he would come home and his wife and him would get in an argument, and he would say something like, "Tell me more about that." And her immediate response was, "Stop that. Whatever you're just doing right there, stop that. I don't want you to
whatever like, trap
counsel
you're laying.
Me." Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
That's a great point, though. And it's true. And, you know, at work, if you chew out somebody, then there's going to be HR who eventually comes and sits you down and says, "Hey, don't do that. Otherwise, you know, you're going to have real problems and you mm-hmm. might lose your job." At home, we don't have that. You know, we don't have that check and balance. Mm-hmm. We have to be our own. We have to be with our spouses, and especially for our kids' sake, you know? Because, like, your four-year-old doesn't have all the tools that HR has to come and try to deal with your belligerence. Your four-year-old's just going to suffer.
You have to create a reporting system for your four-year-old.
Good luck.
If you have a problem with your parent, please complete this form.
Yeah. A 2-3 week turnaround time.
That's right.
During which I can vent as much as I want. But yeah.
That's good.
But the other side that you said is true, like using management tools or mindfulness tools or emotional intelligence tools just to manipulate your situation at home is really different.
Mm.
And I don't think I'm wise enough to parse that out yet.
Mm.
But I've seen misuses of that kind of thing in the past.
It's strange because I feel like it's something that we know the receiver knows that. Right, mm-hmm. It's obvious to the receiver when that happens.
Yeah,
and yet this. So in some ways, we can identify that it's not a skill alone that makes for a good
mm-hmm.
family relationship. It's not just skills.
Yeah,
skills don't get you all the way there.
And the skill, right? The skill is not a moral evil or
no,
good.
That's right.
It's amoral. So it's something in the application. It's something in the person
mm-hmm.
That could misuse it or use it appropriately.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. So what, we'll move on because I can see we're getting into about,
oh yeah, I've had some time.
Yeah. We're about 30 minutes or so, which is good. Traditions or rituals that you either have or want to have with your children.
Yeah. Well, I already mentioned the one I loved of the dinner table being mm. that. So one that sounds silly but is very important to me is growing up, whenever we would wake up in the morning, and we weren't really, the whole family, we weren't early risers. So maybe like 7:30, 8, something, we would all wake up. And we had this ritual, I guess is the right way of saying it, of always saying good morning, always saying how did you sleep, always saying how are you doing today, often accompanied with a hug or something. And that was a thing that when I first got married, my wife comes from a culture, from a household where that was just not a normal thing. It was pretty common to wake up and just get going about the day, and have the first words spoken to each other arise from some sort of practical thing, like, do you want eggs with your breakfast? You know, but I found out when my wife came to me and said, "Do you want eggs with your breakfast?" I was kind of let down by that interaction. Like, but how are you today? Like, good morning. I love you. Do you love me? Like, so that was a silly, that was an interesting culture bump that my wife and I had. But I realized at that point it was something I really wanted to carry forward. I want to always greet my kids really intentionally first thing in the morning. Maybe it was one of those rituals that built into the healthy, safe environment that I felt growing up. Maybe that was one of the things that mattered. I don't know, but something that matters to me now that I want to carry forward. It's a silly little ritual, right?
No, it's a good one. I mean, I wouldn't have, that wouldn't have been the first thing that would have come to mind as a ritual, but it makes me think about, yeah, what do I do in the morning when I get up?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. I think I say good morning. Do I? I say goodbye when I leave. It's interesting the things that one would consider a ritual, and it is, surely.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was very conspicuous, too.
But it's a very small one,
because
but it
each
matters.
Of us did it for each other of us. So each one of us made it a point to have that first interaction with each other. So it was actually a lot. You know,
like, good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning, how are you? Good morning, good morning, good morning.
Normally we were stumbling out of bed and out of our rooms at different moments, right? So each time the next one stumbled out, it was a new check-in. So it was very conspicuous. Like, I realize now, not exactly normal, but really pleasant. Everyone knows that everyone else cares about them right from the first interaction of the day. It's kind of cool.
That is.
It is a ritual. You know, rituals in my mind, they're like the things that you do, you don't think about doing.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Traditions, different traditions. I love traditions.
Yeah.
Most of those, I think, are more like, in my mind, are annual things.
Okay. So you think about traditions as kind of bigger moments, but less often.
Yeah.
Rituals more as a regular.
In my head. Yeah.
Rhythm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, well, tradition then. What would the tradition be that you would do for your kids, or will do, or have been doing, that's been meaningful?
Well, I mean, this is not uncommon, but Christmas was a big deal. For us, it was Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve was the time when we always got together with extended family. And we had a couple components that always happened. We always had steak dinner and sang Christmas carols together and did a little gift exchange, just like one gift per person. And we normally did it where, like, we would draw names earlier in the year. So you were going to get a gift for me, I was going to get a gift for you. So everyone got just the one gift.
So you didn't have to get everybody didn't have to get
30 gifts. Yeah.
Six gifts for everybody. Yeah.
It was a good little system. But it was the most meaningful day of the year to me growing up. And just having it be exactly the same every year was a big deal. We always had T-bone steaks, and they were always good. And we always sang the Christmas carols, and my grandpa always played the guitar while we sang, and we always had fun giving the gifts to each other. So that was an incredibly meaningful tradition for me. I'm trying to think of some other good traditions. And yes, that is something I want to carry forward. We haven't been doing T-bones, unfortunately, because they're so hard to find reliably. If I could get a butcher that I have a good relationship with and he could, you know, give me T-bones, maybe I'd do that. So it's just been generally steaks. But Christmas Eve, yeah, big deal. Most people, I think Christmas Day is the bigger deal, but for us, it was Christmas Eve.
So you guys did gifts and the T-bone steak on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, with extended family.
Okay.
So that's the big everyone's here moment.
Gotcha.
Christmas Day was always just more intimate.
Did you guys do gifts again on Christmas Day?
Just between, you know, core family, like was it, mom and dad and siblings.
Was it still the gift exchange, or was it?
No, it was more whatever happened to happen.
Whoever got a gift for whoever.
Yeah.
That wasn't as big a deal.
Yeah, there was much less structure around Christmas Day, actually.
That's interesting.
It was just kind of an intimate family thing, what we felt like doing that year, and it changed. And maybe that's why Christmas Eve was so much more important to me, is because it was so much more tradition.
Yeah. What do you think, and this will be the last question, what is one thing that you wish you had known before you became a father? Or to put it a different way, if you could go back and tell yourself one thing, what would that one thing be?
Well, you know, I'm still pretty new at this. 4 years.
Hey, 4 years.
I guess I have a college degree now. I've got a bachelor's in fatherhood. But you've got like the double PhD on me, right? Not to say that you're old. So going back, what would I tell myself? What would I wish? Can I say three?
You can say as many as you want.
Say a couple. First, really practically, go on as many trips as you can before you have a kid, before you have kids at all, because there's something magical about like, hey, do you want to go somewhere? Yeah, let's go somewhere. And then you get in the car and then you go. This is an impossibility for the rest of the time that you have children. There will always be more of a process and a rigmarole. So take trips. Take a lot of trips before the kid comes. So then after the kid comes, I think what I wish I'd known or someone had told me was that you can prepare yourself a little bit by thinking through all of your hobbies and all of your preferences and all of the little things in your day and in your life that you like, and just imagining what if you had to give that up. Because the reality is you probably will, temporarily or for a long time. Do you like sleeping till 7:30? My oldest kid has not slept past like 6:30 for his entire life. And I was definitely a 7:30 to 8 kind of happy wake up time.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like a little thing, but psychologically it can be difficult to sit there and realize, wait a minute, I have to wake up early every morning forever.
At least for as long as I can envision
for at
life
least
lasting.
18 years, maybe. Like, there is no end in sight. I will have to wake up because my child is awake and either needs my attention or demands my attention. At first he needed it, now he demands it. Now he'll just run in and jump on the bed. But applying that kind of thinking to your whole life, like I did, I played maybe 2-3 hours of video games a week before having kids, which I thought was reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it. It was a good pastime, right? But as soon as it had a kid, first of all, it became difficult to find the 2 or 3 hours. But second of all, I eventually, maybe a year or two in, realized that every time I chose to do something that did not include my family, I was choosing to exclude my family. Or, you know, to step away from my family.
It was an opportunity cost.
It was a big opportunity cost.
Choosing that activity, yeah. Understand that.
And after realizing that, which was a little while, it was a while, I began to see the advantages of either taking up new hobbies or changing what I was doing so that it was more inclusive of my wife and kids. If my wife and kids could do it too, then they were happier. And I was happier at the end of the day, even though I wasn't happy initially when I realized I couldn't do, for example, the video game I wanted to play.
Mm-hmm.
That did not make me happy in that moment. That was kind of frustrating. but only for that moment. Taking up a hobby or an activity that my wife and my kids can participate in is a profound source of enjoyment now. So beforehand, having someone say, hey, just imagine every little bit of your life that you like right now. Imagine what it would be like if you needed to give that up for the sake of your kids, for the sake of your family, for the sake of being a father. Imagine if you had to give it up and just work through getting to peace with that. Maybe you won't. Like, I know dads who are able to maintain a couple of hours of video games in a week, and they're fine. I don't think they're sinful or evil. But going through the process of just getting to the point of being okay with giving up things, I think gets you most, if not all, of the value.
Primes or preps your mind to what could happen.
Yeah, and it kind of prevents idolatry, you know, like, this is the thing. I don't want to give up this last thing. Like,
it's not quite as
if
jarring.
If it's the last thing you're holding on to, then it's a problem. Yeah. Like,
yeah. Not quite as jarring, too, if you prepare yourself to give them up versus you suddenly realize that it's this or that.
And with kids, it's intimate. You give up your sleep right. You give up your right to your own food. You give up your right to your privacy in the bathroom. Like, you give up everything, at least at first, with little kids, right? All of it will be on the table.
Yeah. Someone asked me recently, they said something along the lines of, I've only got one, I don't know how you do it with six. And my response was, you just have to be prepared to have all your dreams and desires smashed on the rocks.
I agree. I only have two. Like,
yeah, every time I think you think they're all smashed, and then you have another kid, and you're like, no, I still have some others that
I was holding on to.
Yeah, there were still some desires out there that I thought I was going to have or get.
Yeah.
But you're right, it is a wonderful thing. Strangely, something that God uses, I think, to grow us.
It's got to be a part of that sanctification process, I think.
For sure, it is. Cool. Awesome. Well, that's all the questions I have. We're concluding.
It's been a great conversation.
I don't know if I should say thank you for listening, because I don't know where this is going to go, but...
If anyone ever listens,
then...
Thank you.
Praise be to God. good.
Fellow fathers and friends, so glad you could join us for this episode. To stay connected, visit our website at fatherandfriend.com. Sign up for our monthly newsletter, or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media sites. Be sure to like, follow, and share with fellow dads and families in your community. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, send us a message and let us know. Until our next episode, keep showing up, loving deeply, and making an impact for the good of your family. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Father and Friend.